Wes Anderson and Juman Maluf are coming to the Kunsthistorisches Museum. This autumn, we are presenting a very special exhibition, which will be quite unlike anything we've ever done before. We have given Wes and Juman a very special but somewhat overwhelming invitation to sort through all of the objects in our museum. Egyptian mummies, Greek and Roman antiquities, old master paintings, the Kunstkammer, the Imperial Treasury, the Crown Jewels, ethnographic objects from the Weltmuseum, the Theatre Museum, Schloss Ambras, carriages and sleighs, costumes, an embarrassment of riches. What they're going to do, we're not going to tell you just yet, but you can come to the Kunsthistorisches Museum and find out.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Several years ago, the Kunsthistorisches Museum in Vienna began inviting artists to sift through the museum's more than 4 million objects and create exhibitions filtered through the artist's own unique point of view. First up in 2012 was Ed Ruscha. Known for his paintings of gas stations and other American iconography, Vienna is a long way from Ruscha's early days growing up in Oklahoma City. But it worked. Recently, the museum invited Wes Anderson, the Oscar-nominated director of the Grand Budapest Hotel and the Royal Tenenbaums, along with his partner, acclaimed designer and illustrator Juman Maluf, to take on the same gargantuan task. They ended up choosing 423 objects for their show, of which 350 actually came from the museum's warehouse and had never before been publicly shown. The show, complete with a perfectly Andersonian title of Spitz Mouse Mummy in a Coffin and Other Treasures, runs through April 2019. We recently sat down for a transatlantic chat with Kunsthistorisches Museum curator Jasper Sharp to talk about the show, how it came together, and much more. Tell me how the whole idea for this collaboration with Wes Anderson and Juman Maluf began. Where was the seed for this idea born?
When I was invited by the director of my museum 7 or 8 years ago now to conceive of a completely new program of exhibitions for the museum, which would bring us closer to modern and contemporary art. Our collections span about 5,000 years, and they stop around the year 1800. So there's the last 200 years of art history we are missing. And she invited me to put together a program of exhibitions that would engage with this period of art history that we don't have among our own collections. And I looked closely at what other historical museums all around the world were doing, what types of exhibitions would make sense for us. And among the various things that we have started to do is a series of exhibitions for which we invite remarkable creative individuals to spend a sustained period of time visiting the museum over 1 or 2 or 3 years, visiting all of our collections, diving into the storage rooms, meeting all the curators, meeting all the conservators, with the aim of making a personal selection of objects from our collection for a public exhibition. And we began this, our first guest curator who did this was the American artist Ed Ruscha. He did this in 2012. I wanted to begin with someone whose work didn't demonstrate a very obvious debt to historical European art. We continued in 2016 with the British writer and ceramicist Edmund Duval, who was the author of The Hair with the Amber Eyes. And in between those two projects, I met Wes and Juman completely by chance at the museum through a mutual friend. They were visiting, and they asked me if I would walk them through the museum. And what actually happened is they walked me through the museum and showed me all of their favorite things. And it became clear very quickly that they knew our museum already extremely well. They'd been coming here for 10 or 15 years regularly. And on that day that we met, I resolved to invite them to be our third guest curators as part of this series. And that's where the whole thing began.
So when you were walking with them through the museum and they start pointing things out, the wheels begin turning, or had you thought at all already that they might be a good choice? It had never crossed my mind.
I mean, to be honest, I had thought that I would like to get out of the world of visual art in terms of, you know, Ed is a painter, Edmund is a sculptor, a potter. I spend more time with painters and sculptors and photographers than I do with filmmakers or writers or musicians. And I thought it'd be interesting to have a look, someone observe our collection from another point of view. So I had already been thinking, who could this be? And it just sort of presented itself with this wonderful serendipity that we met. And their reactions to the objects were different than those I've gotten used to from artists. They responded in a completely different way. They were not drawn towards the masterpieces in the collection. They were drawn towards the more curious objects. And as soon as we began to get into storage, they began to show a deep interest in objects that were overlooked or ignored by our own curatorial staff.
When you have a museum that has this gap that you mentioned where the collection stops at a certain point and there is the fear that it could become stale or the fear that it could become seen as not an active space, by bringing in people like this, beyond just the name recognition and their different unique point of view, there has to be some element where you're trying to reactivate the public's engagement with the museum. Is that part of the whole idea behind this?
It's exactly it. I mean, you know, we have lots of ambassadors for our collections. We have our own curators. We have our own educators. But occasionally a voice from the outside and a sort of unexpected voice stirs something in one's public that one's own in-house team simply can't do because they're almost too close to it. What they've done with their exhibition is actually two things. They've taken some very familiar objects to us that we see every day because they're on permanent display and presented them in a completely unfamiliar manner. So we learn more and new things about objects that we thought we knew everything about. And at the same time, they present objects that we are completely unfamiliar with. The exhibition that they put together for us contains close to 450 objects, which is the largest exhibition of our collection we've ever mounted. And more than 350 of those objects come directly from our storage rooms. And I would guess that the vast majority of those works from storage have never once been shown publicly since the museum existed 127 years ago. So they are literally bringing things out of the shadows and showing them to us. And even showing the curators who look after these collections, in a sense, what they have and how wonderful these objects can look if they are given the chance, should we say.
How familiar were you with the work of Wes Anderson and Juman Maalouf? And obviously, his profile is very large. Her work is very well respected, but maybe not as known. Did you have to kind of go back and reacquaint yourself with their work? Or, you know, where were you in that spectrum?
I have seen, I think, pretty much all of Wes's films. I had seen them by the time I met him. I'm not a bigger fan of his films, I would say, than of other directors. I just enjoy them. Juman, I didn't know anything about when I met her. About 10 months after we first met, her debut novel came out, and I devoured it. And, you know, I did go back and look at some of the films again during the process of putting the exhibition together. almost just to sort of try and reconcile the two things and to see where they might intersect, the sort of filmic language and the language of doing an exhibition. In the end, the exhibition that they've produced is a very finely calibrated synthesis of both of their approaches. Juman was as involved in the selection of objects, the placement of objects, the determination of color schemes, all sorts of things, as Wes was. People obviously find it easier to draw parallels with his films, the symmetry that runs through the exhibition, the color palette, a certain protagonist in the exhibition, like children, they immediately latch onto and draw parallels with his films. But actually, there is every bit as much of Juman's own imagination and background and autobiography in the exhibition as there is his.
When the work is being done behind the scenes and things are being put together, when you bring in these guests, are they treated with the same level of access and respect as any curator of the museum would be? How are they integrated into the system?
So at the beginning, they just look. They look and look and look and look and look. I mean, there's 4.5 million objects in our collections. Our collection is scattered over about 7 different buildings in the city of Vienna and a big Renaissance castle in Innsbruck in the Alps. So they just looked at everything. And once they had looked at everything that was on public display, which they did alone with me, we didn't need anyone's help or guidance for that. We then went a step deeper and we began to look in the storages. For that, we needed our curators and our conservators who sort of took them. And from there, we went into deep storage, things that literally had never come out and see the light of day. As soon as we'd gone through that entire process, which took the best part of a year and a half, they began to formulate their ideas of, you know, how are you going to whittle down this huge collection into something consumable in an exhibition? As soon as they developed the ideas, I articulated their intentions in a short text, and I sent it out to all of our collection curators and mobilized them to begin sending in ideas of objects from their own collections. And some of them embraced it immediately. Some of them are huge fans of Wes's work and have read Juman's book. Others were more skeptical because they paid very little attention to the hierarchy and the canon of the history of art. They're not really interested in masterpieces. They were not interested in the most important work, the work with the most interesting provenance, the work with the best exhibition history, all of the yardsticks that our own curators use to judge the value and importance of objects were of complete irrelevance to Wes and Juman as they made their way through the collections. They were beginning to select their objects according to completely different criteria: color, function, size, material. Or much more intuitive categories, almost like the categories that a child would organize objects by. And this took some of our curators a little bit by surprise. You know, you have a curator who studied for 14 years to earn his doctorate in history of art, and then you pick up the phone and call him and you say, I need green things. And there's just a sort of long silence on the end of the phone. And you get told to come back when you have a more serious grown-up question. But that was how we had to do it. And it took time and energy to get some of the curators on board. But once they began to see what was coming together, when the first lists of objects began to take shape, they all embraced it. And actually, they all took pride in getting as many of the objects from their collections into the exhibition. So there was a little tipping point at a certain point for the good when they understood what Wes and Juman were trying to do.
Is there a single narrative that you can describe for the show, or are there multiple narratives that run throughout the whole exhibition?
I think what the success of the exhibition is it can be read on multiple levels at the same time. It's fun and deeply intellectual at the same time. Those two things, you know, often struggle to meet on equal terms in exhibitions. It's deeply playful. On the other hand, it's like a love letter to the act of collecting, the act of ownership, the act of contemplation. They've built small rooms with hundreds of objects in them that remind me, at least, of the origins of our collections. When the emperors and archdukes of the Habsburg dynasty were assembling these collections in Prague and Innsbruck and Vienna hundreds of years ago. They weren't doing it for a public museum. This was an entirely private obsession, and they would have chambers of curiosities and treasures that they would come into and rearrange and play with and organize and add to. And it was a sort of greedy, private, obsessive activity. And they've tried to recreate some of the feel of this privacy. There are no labels in the exhibition telling you what any of the objects are. You have to take a little booklet outside the show and bring it in and try and work out what everything is from little drawings. So the spirit that it imbues is very much something that goes back to the origins of the collecting of our own collections, but also to the origins of collecting generally, how we all begin collecting as small children.
Can you talk for a moment about the museum generally? You've talked about the size of this exhibition and how large it is, but give our listeners a sense of the breadth and scope of what they were working with and what a monumental task it would be to whittle anything down from the starting place.
The collections begin in ancient Egypt, run all the way up through ancient Greece, ancient Rome. Then the earliest artworks that are produced, the beginning of the Italian Renaissance, all the way up through the Dutch Golden Age. A wonderful Kunstkammer of ivory and gold and silver and rock crystal. We have tapestries, we have coins and medals, arms and armor, carriages and sleighs, costumes, musical instruments. There's an entire ethnographic museum of treasures from all over the world. There's a theater museum of costumes and props and theater sets. There is a castle in Innsbruck, which we also look after. Almost all of the collections stop at 1800. The only ones that are still collecting today are the coin cabinet and the ethnographic collection. They're still gathering objects from around the world, objects of cultural importance and cultural history. This is the hardest part when we invite these curators. What are you going to do? What's your way in? And how do you also prevent yourself from being utterly intimidated by the challenge? I remember Ed Ruscha looking utterly forlorn after his first day of walking through the collections. And he said to me over lunch, I've seen every idea that I've had in the last 50 years. I've seen on the wall of the museum here this morning. And he actually titled his curated exhibition after a line from Mark Twain, "The ancients stole all of our great ideas," as if to say, you know, this is a hopeless task. You know, where are you going to begin? Western Juman didn't have as much difficulty as our previous two guest curators. Their ideas began to come to them quite quickly. A really interesting thing happened to me during this project. I saw the outer limits of our collection for the very first time. I'd always imagined that we just had endless amounts of things because that's the way it had. Or I'd only ever scratched the surface of the collection. And for this, Western Juman, for example, have an entire section of portraits of young children. And they asked me to look at every portrait of a child in our collection. So I looked at hundreds and hundreds of portraits of children until there were none left. And I realized I'd reached the bottom of the barrel. And it's a sign of how seriously they took this project, that we reached the bottom of the barrel on all sorts of different categories, which I didn't personally think was even possible, given how much the Habsburgs themselves had collected over the years.
So on a base level, this action of going through this process with these different guest curators makes you a better curator because you know the collection even better by the time the process is complete. Would that be...
I mean, even though I'm a modern curator and I sit out of the time period that our museum sort of has in its holdings, I think I probably know our complete collections better than almost any of the individual curators who know their own fields immaculately but don't really stray too far out of that. Our educators have got a very all-round view of things. But yeah, it's, you know, and we also learn from them. They dig out paintings that we have in storage and put them on the wall and shine a light on them. And they look remarkable all of a sudden. And often when these curated shows are over, some of these rescued objects find their way back into the permanent displays of the museum. It's almost as if they've had their dignity returned to them by a guest, an outsider. And our curators are seduced by what they see. Or they come up with new pairings of objects, which the curators just think, work brilliantly. And when the objects at the end of the curated exhibition go back to their normal home, they maybe go back in a new configuration. So we learn from them, I have to say. They point us in directions towards things that maybe we've just stopped looking at.
When you're working with someone like Wes Anderson, who, when you see his films, are so intricate and so controlled, you would imagine, at least from an outside perspective, that he would be quite a, I don't want to say control freak, but someone who's very, very in charge of things. And so when you're working with someone like that, what was the collaboration like in terms of who's running the ship and making the decisions and all those things?
Yeah, it's a very good question. Wes and Juman are complete and utter perfectionists, which I love because I'm a perfectionist myself, although I realized I'm not in comparison to them. Hundreds of emails bouncing back and forth every day, the longest game of email ping pong of my life. Every single detail looked at and looked at again. The interesting thing is we have to give up some degree of control. My role in this project is not as a curator, which is my normal function in the museum when I assemble an exhibition of paintings from other museums, for example. My role here is very much that of the sort of the producer or the facilitator who takes the vision handed to him by the director of the project and makes it happen. So I had to liaise with all the collections to negotiate the loans. I had to help with the fundraising. I had to, you know, smooth out all the various sort of press commitments and things like that. So it was a different role for me. It would be difficult, I would imagine, were one not convinced by the vision that one was being handed. But when we began to see, you know, this thing take shape, and, you know, there's an element of trust in here. When we invited them, we basically gave them a blank check. We had no idea if they would choose 12 objects or 450. We had no idea how much.
So the scope of it could be to their choosing, any size they would like, basically.
They could have chosen a single object. Nothing restricts them, which is the thrilling thing about it. I've never chosen a guest curator yet where I could tell you more or less before we started what sort of thing they were going to do. I think that simply wouldn't be interesting. And I'm really keen on trying to choose brilliant people. And I could maybe have a guess about what kind of direction this could go in, but generally we just have no idea. You know, one day someone might do something that's inherently critical of the institution, you know, which has been done before by artists. So there is a huge amount of trust and a blank check that's handed to them for projects like this, which is precisely what makes the whole thing so exciting, because there's an element of the unknown to it.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by Landscape Paintings. Under near relentless assault since the advent of photography in the mid-19th century, landscape paintings are much more than just remnants of a bygone era or decor for fleabag motels. From humble postcard-sized pastoral vistas to massive waterfall depictions, you can almost hear and feel these sumptuous scenes needn't seem inferior. Indeed, to artists everywhere, we at MC say there's no shame in getting back to the land. Never. Look out the window, take a picture, now try to paint it. See? Enough said.
Having had two visual artists first and then moving into a director and an author and illustrator, are you now thinking about how you can stretch beyond these bounds even more moving forward? I'm assuming you'll continue this series.
Next one will be in 2020. The biggest hiccup that we faced working with Wes and Juman was, in contrast to Ed and Edmund, our previous two guest curators, they were less familiar with the constraints that come with exhibiting historical objects. So keeping things out of reach of visitors, climate control, humidity, temperature, what surfaces objects are allowed to sit on, you know, felt, metal, glass, what are they allowed to come into contact with? These were things that Ed and Edmund instinctively understood because they exhibit their own works in museums regularly. For Wes and Juman, it was a source of great frustration because they never encountered this sort of thing when they're building a film set or writing a novel. You have what you need. And here, they had to make compromises left, right, and center. So there is an advantage to working with people who already have a great familiarity with museums and all of the inherent controls and checks that museums impose on certain curatorial activities. On the other hand, it's relatively easy to explain to someone early on, and it doesn't need to be the hiccup. But I think I'd really love to work with someone maybe next time from the literary world. I think it would be very interesting. We already have a pretty good idea who we will invite for 2020, and we have a pretty good idea who we'll invite for 2022. But it's something we definitely want to continue. It was very hard to get going at the beginning to convince our curators the first time we did this, and it gets easier each time. So it would be a shame to give up now when the wheels have started turning.
Since everyone's pulling from the same base collection, and I'm thinking about Ed Ruscha. So we're based here in Oklahoma, and Ed Ruscha grew up here in Oklahoma.
Absolutely, yeah.
Could you see that in his exhibition? Could you see, you know, since he's pulling from there, is his American perspective, is, you know, everyone has kind of a, you know, different, obviously, Wes Anderson is from here, too.
You could completely read Ed's biography in his show.
Wow.
It was a completely autobiographical exhibition. It was fascinating. I didn't realize it when we were putting it together. He never articulated it as such in words. But the moment he'd left and the show was open and I'd slept and I was able to look at the show with fresh eyes, it was only then that I really understood what he'd done. So there were references to his Sunset Strip project. There was a rattlesnake. There was a coyote he borrowed from the Natural History Museum. There were some paintings he chose simply because they had widescreen formats, which reminded him of cinema and film. There were all sorts of aspects of his life in the exhibition. Edmund Duval's project was also extremely personal and autobiographical. His family lived in Vienna until 1938, when they were forced to flee as a Jewish banking family. Many of them lost their lives under the Nazis, and the director of our own museum in 1938 stood in his former family home with a clipboard dealing with the dispersal of all the family's possessions. So for him to step back into our museum in Vienna and curate an exhibition drawn from our collections was a huge act of generosity and reconciliation. And Wes and Juman, very similar. There are all sorts of little autobiographical moments in the show. They didn't even realize it themselves, I don't think, when they were doing it. It was only when the whole show was standing that I remember walking through the day before the opening with Juman, and she said, "My word, I'm seeing my whole life in this room." You know, so it's funny. I think we would all slightly curate ourselves if we were given this choice. I think it's the only way to do it, if you're being honest to yourself.
So just to finish up, the show is open. People are coming to see it. What has the reaction been from visitors to the museum? I mean, I'm sure you had some expectations, but what's been the real reaction?
People, I normally get a couple of messages from friends saying, you know, went to see the show. I really enjoyed it. I've had a message from almost everybody I know who's been to see the show. It has provoked people to put pen to paper or fingers to keyboards. And the thing that they've said more than anything else is it's taught them how to look at objects again. They've looked in a way that they have never looked at objects before. This is partly to do with removing labels so that you are obliged to look. They take time. I think people spend longer in this exhibition than almost any exhibition that I've seen before. And people walk around with a smile on their face. They're not being given a lecture. We recorded the audio guide for the exhibition that you can listen to as you walk around. And it was recorded by the actor Jason Schwartzman, where he interviewed Wes and Juman and myself. And it's a fascinating audio guide because there's not a single date given, because they don't know the dates of any of the objects. There's not a single artist's name given to you because they don't always know the name. This type of information was simply not of great importance to them. It's a discussion about the soul of the exhibition, and it's really fascinating to listen to. And I hear a lot of people walking around listening to it, and it's a nice companion. And finally, the whole thing then travels next year to the Prada Foundation in Milan, where it will slightly grow. We're going to add a little bit to the show, but we get to have a sort of sequel of the exhibition in Italy in September next year.
The Grand Budapest Hotel has a lot going on visually, but the propulsion of the plot centers on a single work of art, a painting called Boy with Apple by a Renaissance master named Johannes van Hoytel the Younger. Don't worry if you've never heard of him, because he doesn't exist. And as far as we know, there was never a Johannes van Hoytel the Older either. In fact, Boy with Apple was created specifically for the film by acclaimed English artist Michael Taylor. Anderson and Taylor eventually enlisted the help of a young dancer named Ed Monroe to sit for the painting. "All I was told," says Monroe, "was that I was going to sit for a portrait which would be used as a, quote, hero prop in a film." If you know the films of Wes Anderson, the idea that he would invent an artist from whole cloth seems rather fitting. In his movies, no matter how familiar they may seem, there's always a sense of something slightly removed from reality. But none of that mattered to Boy with Apple artist Michael Taylor. Quote, "I wasn't familiar with Wes Anderson's films when I was hired to paint Boy with Apple. But now that I come to think about it, that gave me the advantage of a clean palette, so to speak. I think familiarity with his aesthetic could have been very contagious, and I feel the painting benefits from having its own identity." That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.